morning, everyone. I want to welcome you to an ITIF event on the Chinese semiconductor industry and its connection to Chinese innovation policy. I'm Rob Atkinson, president of ITIF, and we've got a really great panel and presenter this morning, which I will introduce in just a second, but let me just give some context for this event. We tend to think of China, or at least some people think of China, as essentially a low-wage commodity assembly economy. They assemble iPhones and they assemble DVD players and all the rest. And the Chinese government has seen this as well, and particularly in the last 6 years have decided that they want to have a different kind of economy and essentially move up the value chain to become a more technologically advanced economy. This was really the signal event of that was the 2006, what's been called the MLP, but is essentially the guidelines for the implementation of the National Medium and Long-Term Program for Science and Technology Development. And the MLP was, I think, a very important turning point in Chinese economic policy because it really represented a shift from essentially a commodity production-based FDI attraction strategy, attracting foreign companies to put factories there, to a much more of an indigenous innovation with Chinese companies at the center driving innovation. And so the MLP sought to, quote, create an environment for encouraging innovation independently, promote enterprises to become the main body of making technological innovation, and strive to build an innovative type economy. Right after that, the Chinese 11th five-year plan refined all these industries and targeted 16 industries, including large-scale integrated circuit manufacturing. And most recently, the 12th five-year plan focused on a number of key areas, including very large-scale integrated circuit equipment and manufacturing, which is essentially semiconductors. So that's the context for what we're doing today. And we're going to start with my colleague Dieter Ernst, who's a senior fellow and professor at the East-West Center. Dieter is suffering from a Washington cold because he lives in Honolulu, so thought this was cold weather, I think. But Dieter has a really very, very impressive background in technology and economic policy. He's a former senior advisor to the OECD. He's a former research director at the Berkeley Roundtable on International Economy, BRI. He's a former professor of business at the Copenhagen School of Business. He's also co-chaired the Advisory Committee on the U.S. Social Science Research Council. He's been an advisor to the OECD, the World Bank, National Bureau of Asian Research, UN Conference on Trade and Development, and a number of other organizations. He has a number of books, which I would encourage you to look at. Most recently, Towards Greater Pragmatism, China's Approach to Innovation and Standardization. Another book, Indigenous Innovation and Globalization, The Challenge for Chinese Standardization Strategy. China's Innovation Policy is a Wake-Up Call for America. And finally, The New Geography of Knowledge in the Electronics Industry, Asia's Role in Global Innovation Networks. We're going to be joined, we are joined, there's great. Kirby Jefferson, Kirby, welcome. Joining us by the magic of Skype. Kirby is in Dalian, China as we speak, and it would be around 9 p.m. there, is that right?
About 10 p.m.
10 p.m., okay. Thank you for joining us on your personal time on such a late time for you. Kirby is the general manager for Intel Semiconductor Dalian, Fab 68. So Fab 68 is a factory in China. It's Intel's first 300-millimeter wafer facility in Asia, and Intel's first new fab at a new site since 1992. It was a $2.5 billion investment Intel made in China, and is one of the largest foreign private investments in China. Kirby has led the Fab 68 effort from an initial concept into its current high-volume manufacturing. Kirby joined Intel in 1980 and has been involved in 9 factory startups, holding a variety of jobs in manufacturing and engineering. He's also executive chairman of the Northeast China chapter of the American Chamber of Commerce. So thank you for joining us. Brian Tui is the president and CEO of the Semiconductor Industry Association. For those of you who know SIA, you would probably think that SIA is out in Silicon Valley, where they were since their inception, but I think 3 years ago, approximately, SIA moved to DC and is in this building now, so it's great that SIA is here in town now. Before coming to SIA, Brian held executive leadership positions at Pharma. He was also a senior vice president of Deka Research and Development, a medical device company, and also was at a wireless network operator and service provider, Aircel. He has served as the Director of International Government Affairs and Planning of the European Business Unit of Iridium, the global satellite company, and also has worked for a number of years with the U.S. Department of Commerce, and as a member of the Department of Commerce and State Department's International Trade Advisory Committee. Alan Wolf is expected to be joining us, so I'll just introduce Alan, assuming that he's just running a few minutes late. Alan is Ambassador Alan Wolf is a member of the International Trade Practice at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, a law firm here in town. And he's really one of the leading trade lawyers in Washington and has extensive experience in semiconductor trade policy. He's also on the board, chairman of the board of the National Foreign Trade Council, member of the Advisory Committee on the Science, Technology, and Economic Policy Board of the National Academies, and on the board of the U.S.-China Legal Cooperation Fund. So with that introduction, I'm going to have Dieter kick us off with some slides, and then we'll take it from there.
Dieter, do you want to come up here? I guess a little bit here.
If I can,
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, the semiconductor industry in China, at least officially, is very high up on the list of priorities of China's indigenous innovation policy. And so, for that reason, it's obviously a good industry to look at if one wants to understand the dynamics, the drivers, and the impact of China's indigenous innovation policy, and maybe also some of its limitations, some of its inherent limitations. Now, the Now, the semiconductor industry, however, poses an interesting puzzle. The Chinese government has invested a lot of effort and resources in, you know, basically building up indigenous innovation and production capabilities in this industry. And despite all of these efforts, this industry still plays a relatively limited role in semiconductor production, IC design as an innovator. Why is that? What's behind that? That's the question I would like to at least address a little bit. I mean, I will barely scratch the surface, but at least that's what I'm looking at. And my hypothesis is that in the end, China's indigenous innovation policy has, among other defining characteristics, one characteristic, and that is maybe it neglects a little bit too much the role of industry structure. And what is defining the industry structure of the semiconductor industry in China is its deep integration into the global semiconductor value chain. Extremely deep. I mean, at a similar stage of development of its semiconductor industry, Korea was arguably much less deeply integrated in the global value chain than China is today. And so that deep integration, that particular type of industry structure, poses a fundamental dilemma for China's indigenous innovation policy. To what degree is actually its indigenous innovation policy compatible with globalization, with this deep integration in the global value chain. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just starting out with one or two slides on what in my view is the fundamental indigenous innovation dilemma in China. Then I will briefly touch on some of the achievements and in particular the weaknesses of the Chinese semiconductor industry. Thirdly, just again very briefly talking about the tension between deep integration in the global value chain of this industry and the ways or means of developing domestic innovative capabilities. And finally, I will just talk briefly about recent developments in China, policy developments, that is, and we'll see what kind of implications these developments, or to what degree these recent developments shed even a clearer light on the question that I'm posing at the beginning. I can see from some faces that maybe it's not very clear. Can you hear me clearly enough?
Yes. Oh, okay. Yes. Very okay. Good.
It's okay, even there. Okay, good. So, let's start. And I hope this thing works. Okay, but I can't see
it. You can see
No, my eyes.
Oh, okay.
So, and this is probably not a pointer, if I may. So, indigenous innovation policy is basically, you know, shaped by an experience. And we have to accept that, I think. The experience is that it's not completely natural and easy for a country like China.
Hey, dear, let's do this. Do it from up here, if you would, because we need to use the microphone. So that would be very, then everybody.
Ah, yeah. Oh, okay.
So here you go. There you go.
And I can see better.
Yeah, you can see it.
Okay. So, if you start from the left, from the first, whatever
box.
Bravo. So, the fundamental idea of indigenous innovation policy is there may be, you know, all the key technologies may be easily transferable. There may be problems. And of course, this is what you call the Wassenaar effect. I mean, technology export restrictions. China, like many other countries, have faced that. And that, of course, has added to an inclination to do things in the following way, that one would try to replicate as much as possible of the value chain in China, and that one would seek to shift the balance from local technology sourcing to a much greater emphasis on domestic R&D and innovation. And if you look at this this graph, you can see, I mean, that's really reflected in the fact that between 2000 and 2010, domestic R&D increased roughly by 10 times, whereas technology import increased by a much lower rate. Now, obviously, for a country like China that is catching up, it's necessary to strengthen domestic R&D. But maybe there is now a point, they have now reached a point where there may be some overshooting, and that's actually the fundamental problem behind all of that. So, if you go to the right, what was the term?
Box.
If you go to the right box, globalization, however, and the deep global integration into global production and innovation networks also offers tremendous possibilities, that is, you know, for accelerating access to key technologies. And that's obviously something that is not completely viewed in the same way or fully understood from the China, by the Chinese policymakers. In any case, these two boxes are, to some degree, you know, in tension, in conflict. What it means if you go now down to the left bottom box, there are de facto two innovation strategies in China that coexist, but with little explicit interaction. On the one side, the indigenous innovation. On the other side, companies that need to function within, you know, a deep integration into these global production innovation networks. That tension is real. I mean, I see it each time, you know, I go there and interview companies, primarily in domestic companies. And that means this for a policy debate raises two issues. The first one for China, the issue, can China actually combine the benefits of both innovation strategies? Can it find a way where it brings into greater harmony these two different models, approaches to innovation? For the US, however, I also think we should a little bit, we should think a little bit more about to what degree we would actually need to slightly adjust our own trade diplomacy. And I say trade diplomacy strategy, knowing that we don't really have a fully strategic approach to trade diplomacy. But in any case, I will get to these points at the end of my presentation. Now, let's get to the achievements. And this is a long list, and basically we are lucky that we have someone like Ed Pauser at PricewaterhouseCoopers, who really does excellent work, and the industry insiders know all of this, so I can do it very quickly. But the main thing I would like to emphasize is, so China actually now shapes the market, the global market for semiconductors. And that is important for companies, you know, for our companies. But what it does not do, it doesn't shape the industry in the sense as a production, as the domestic production. It only has a share. That's the third bullet, a share of the world semiconductor industry of a bit more than 12%. But that share, of course, has increased. Now, China's IC design industry, again, quantitative growth, as you see, impressive. The question is the quality, the real, you know, quality are these designs that shape architectural, IC architectural patterns? Open question, probably not. In terms of the overall design revenue, roughly 8%. The two areas of strength right now are in assembly and packaging and testing. China, by all standards, is number one. Internationally and, of course, domestically, this is the sector that dominates in China. And China is ahead of Taiwan and Japan. Now, the area where China is now gaining strength is optical, optoelectronics, LED in particular, and these other sectors. So these are some strengths. All of that is to say, these policies did produce some results that matter, but they certainly did not produce the results that were on the agenda officially. Let's get to weaknesses. Huge gap between, on the one side, a very large China's very large share in semiconductor consumption with the production, which clearly lags behind. So the gap between these two keeps growing. And one would expect at some stage that it would be reduced, but it keeps growing. The semiconductor trade deficit of China more than doubled since 2005. To roughly 140 billion. And so, again, this shows persistent dependence on imports of advanced ICs. Just to run very quickly through this list, wafer fab, still playing second fiddle. Ed Pauser has this nice, you know, quote where he would say, new plants, but with old technology. And until a few years ago, this was primarily because this was used equipment. This is not anymore the case, but it's primarily reflecting the focus on areas like optoelectronics, like LED, where you don't need the latest process technology. IC design capabilities, I mentioned that. Very important, patent portfolio, still very weak. We don't have the time. If there's a Q&A on that, I can give some data. So support policies, unfortunately, have this inherent tendency to produce periodic excess capacity. For instance, right now, the focus on LED, everyone goes into it. And so we are seeing already very clear signs that there's going to be excess capacity. Standards, primarily standard taker, with one important exception, mobile communication systems, DDS, CDMA, and LTE. Probably after a long, long developing time, probably somewhat shows that China in this area is maybe co-shaping important standards. So all of that is to say, this is something, you know, we need to understand from China's perspective. As long as these weaknesses exist, they feel very strongly that they have a strong rationale for continuing with their indigenous innovation policy. China's innovation system is highly fragmented, and so you have different players. But those who would argue we need to strengthen indigenous innovation and local production, those gain, you know, just from looking at these particular data sets. One more, and then I move on to more to the last points. Domestic innovation barriers. As most of you who deal with China know, this is a whole list. We have a fragmented innovation system, which is a fundamental puzzle, because we are talking about a country where it's supposed to be government-centered top-down, but actually, when you look closer, and we did a study on the standard Chinese standard system, and we can see the very messy fragmentation, inter-agency rivalries, and anyone who is, you know, based in China and dealing with government agencies knows about that. That, of course, constrains the implementation of consistent implementation of any of these policies. Two, quality problems in education, all of that. Top-down technology leapfrogging. Someone at the top sets a vision or a target, and then it's pursued without really clearly analyzing up front the risks of ramping up complex technology systems. Now, the high-speed rail is a very good example for this type of, you know, inherent constraint of innovation policy in China. Public R&D support still, and even more than before, focused on state-owned enterprises. And despite much talk, SMEs are at the margin. You can see, I mean, it's a long list, and I lose too much time if I go through all of that. It's maybe I just point out the last one, weak complementary capabilities. That's what we have. That's what we have in DC, what we have on the West Coast, legal, patent law, standardization, the capacity to coordinate complex innovation networks, to provide integrated solutions. All of that is missing. And so, or at least not completely missing, but it's still in a very in kind of initial state. Okay, and so just to rephrase the argument that I'm basically making in our study is China's indigenous innovation policy fails to take into account the two sides of the deep integration into the global networks. The positive side, deep global integration enables Chinese firms to engage in increasingly sophisticated forms of global technology sourcing. And the firms are doing it. Huawei does it. ZTE does it. Spreadtrum does it. And when you talk to these companies, that's what they talk about. So that's the positive side. The negative side, which we should accept that from the Chinese perspective, this is an issue. Foreign firms right now, they dominate China's semiconductor consumption. I probably didn't show the slide before, but it's really overwhelming. Most of the semiconductor production and design is made for foreign companies. And so foreign companies shape IC design decisions. And this, to some degree, is, of course, a constraining factor to the development of an integrated domestic innovation system. So this fundamental tension is basically what I'm talking about. If I go to the next slide, you know, you can see it. I mean, this is a somewhat stylized picture of the integration of China, a little bit in the middle, you can see, of its integration in the semiconductor value chain, starting, you know, from the design services, design tool providers. So this is constructed focusing on fabless design companies in China. So on the left, these are the sources of inputs for the fabless design companies. On the right are the final users, the end markets, the downstream side. For instance, fabless IC design companies in China are interacting with all of these different participants in the global semiconductor value chain. Again, this has two sides. On the one hand, it means the Chinese fabless semiconductor vendors depend on requirements and specs from all of these different actors. Yeah, it's a fact, okay? It has positive effects, which is the second one. They can source technology, they can learn from all these different participants in the value chain, but also they, in a way, you know, these foreign participants in the global value chain also shape decisions. And that may, to some degree, also be a constraint.
You need to wrap up.
Okay, 2 minutes? Okay. Let me just show you first one nice quote from the CEO of Spreadtrum, a company that is successful. Why? Because it also has a strong link to TD-SCMA. So basically he says, we can get access to all of these things. IC design tools, fab services, open source smartphone software. This, all of that enabled us to accelerate the development of our strengths. And I, you know, in interviews, we continuously get that story. But with government officials, we get the other side. So wrapping up, I would go, is there any interest maybe in the Q&A on the recent developments, policy developments? That would take a little bit longer.
Why don't you do 2 minutes on that and then we'll wrap up.
Okay. So, this doesn't allow me to type in. So basically, these are the two documents. Those in the industry know these documents, right? Okay. The first one, the strategic emerging industries plan, they want to get at 22 nanometers very soon, but they are actually way behind.
You might want to explain what that means. You might want to explain what that means.
That means
where are they now?
Oh, the Spreadtrum is a company that is at 40 nanometer. Spreadtrum is an IC design company that, you know, was betting on moving relatively forward in terms of process technology. aiming at 22 nanometer. Intel is right now where?
22.
Voila. So that is really maybe Samsung, but few others, and maybe TSMC not yet, but they want to go there. But so very ambitious in terms of process technology. A long way to go. Number two, built the, and the word important is entire value chain. And that is something, you know, which is unfortunately very deeply entrenched. You don't need to do that anymore, the entire value chain, because you're deeply integrated in this, you know, global supply chain. So the really interesting thing is the State Council document number 4, and I basically get to the important issue. The important issue is that they now accept focus on production is only one part, and maybe we overemphasized. We should actually also equally emphasize high value-added services. And what they basically do with that is they take into account or take in debates in the EU, manufacturing services in the US, you know, as part of the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership Program. So there is a debate on a high level that we want to do that. How quickly can they implement that? I mean, these plans are written by extremely smart people who are very well informed about the international debates. But what are, and they understand, I mean, that these high knowledge intensive support services and the integration of manufacturing with these services can provide profit margins like Apple, for instance, has. That's what they are looking at. Can they implement it? A big question. My last slide, and then I'm done, is because that goes to our policy implications. Okay. Oops. So, absolutely no doubt, the US semiconductor industry is still way ahead of China in many respects that matter. China's semiconductor industry continues to rely on U.S. technology imports. But what again, I need to emphasize that what we need to understand is that this very fact, you know, creates a rationale for continuing and even strengthening indigenous production and innovation. Okay, so the real issue is, are we, from our perspective, what we should focus on is, are we able to generate enough high-value jobs through exports of U.S. technology to China? And for me, that... Oops. Is it okay? Yeah. So, if you go to the third bullet, I would say we really need to take a hard look at our current trade diplomacy positions. I think, you know, first of all, we should continue to be very blunt about China to put something more substantial on the table to avoid increasing trade disputes. So on this, I fully agree, you know, for instance, with Rob's position. However, we also need to indicate we are willing to accept the Chinese way of governing the economy, including all hidden subsidies, if we get what is our first priority, and that is we need better IP protection, less technical problems with market access, and lower investment barriers throughout. Okay. Okay, and that's basically what I have to say.
Good. Great. Thank you.
Can we switch over to Skype? Kirby, there you go. Wonderful. So Kirby, you're on the ground there in China and see this firsthand, both in terms of what you're doing at Intel and what your competitors are. So if you would share your thoughts with us, that would be great.
Sure, Aaron, Alexis, if you could go ahead and put the slide up that I'd sent to you. Really, I think that what Dr. Ernst referred to in many of his points, I think you're going to hear an echo from me. Capital spending for fab capacity has been growing in China. And if you look at a map, the PricewaterhouseCoopers reports, you'll see that there are a lot of factory or fab locations that are identified in China, but to a large extent, those are very small, either research facilities, university facilities, and in terms of what I would consider or characterize as large-scale manufacturing facilities, it's still relatively small on the worldwide scale. There are local companies, SMIC being the most evident of those, that are Chinese owned. Those companies, or SMIC particularly, is moving down the technology treadmill, if you will. And in fact, today they've got two 28-nanometer fabs that are in construction. But that in and of itself is not going to be sufficient to meet the demands that China has for their internal consumption, much less what China will use in terms of manufacturing of products for the rest of the world. So there doesn't seem to be enough momentum, if you will, for them to be able to keep pace with the rate of consumption that's going on in China. They have developed capabilities around ARM and around MIPS, and there are several companies that have really made some great strides from a design standpoint, from a fabless standpoint, and that seems to be well within the capability. The threshold to entry or the barriers to entry on that aren't quite as high. They also demonstrated through a variety of other different industries a very strong ability to aggressively export. And I think we're all pretty familiar with what those are. I think the real challenge that China's going to have from a semiconductor manufacturing really comes down to the cadence that's going forward with regards to technology development. And I think it's going to be a challenge for China, and it's going to be a challenge, I think, for really much of the rest of the industry as the convergence to sub 20 nanometer technology, which is just plain hard to do, to put it in very simple terms, and with the transition to the 450 millimeter wafer size. Those two elements converging here in the next five or 8 years or so, I think, are likely to force some hands, and it very well could be that the Chinese government recognizes that they need to be doing something fairly dramatic if they hope, from a semiconductor manufacturing standpoint, to really catch up. As Dr. Ernst talked about, and I think we're all aware of, piracy. Continues to be a huge problem from a software standpoint, and certainly IP concerns, intellectual property concerns. It's a big challenge. It's a big challenge for us, and it's a big concern of mine as we brought the factory up here in China. I'm happy to say that I don't feel like there's been a systemic attempt to acquire our technology. I also think that. To a large extent, it's a little bit overblown, because if somebody's really after your technology, they'll figure out how to get people into your fabs, no matter where they are in the world. So, it is a concern, and certainly within Intel senior management, it is a concern, and I suspect within Samsung, as they're looking to put in their large factory in Xi'an, that's a concern. So, there are certainly barriers, and the one thing that I don't have on the slide that Dr. Ernst talked about was the disconnectedness, if you will, of the bureaucracy in China. And as a business is setting up to conduct business, to conduct manufacturing, the hurdles that you've got to navigate through on that are quite complex. And while you would believe that in a manufacturing culture like China has, quite frankly, their desire to move up the value chain from an environmental protection standpoint, from a customs standpoint, supply chain standpoint, so on and so forth, there's a lot of conflict in all of those areas, and it's very difficult for the local officials to really understand what the intentions are coming out of Beijing. And because a lot of the interpretation of those is left at the local level, you find very, very complex challenges that you have to work through very often in working in getting manufacturing set up here. So those are the perspectives that we've got here from our fab here in Dalian, China.
Great. Thank you, Kirby. That's wonderful. We'll get back in more discussion in just a few minutes. Brian, you do it from here.
Perfect. I can sit here, I think. All right. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Brian.
it's a pleasure. Can I borrow the...
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here as part of such a distinguished panel. I really enjoyed listening to Dieter and Kirby's views because they're really very, very interesting. And actually, my comments will be very consistent. And what I'd like to do, perhaps from a different perspective, is talk about four main issues. The first is an overview of what the Chinese semiconductor industry is right now. That's been discussed, and I won't go into great detail on that. The need for global partnerships and collaborations, which has really underpinned the success of the U.S. industry. Some policy recommendations and some concluding remarks about the future. As has been stated, the Chinese industry is growing very rapidly. It accounts for in terms of global consumption, depending on whose figures you use, anywhere between 30 and 45%. PwC puts it at 30. The Chinese government figures put it about 45%, and industry figures put it about 45%. Our statistics are essentially somewhere in the middle, but it's clearly the dominant player in terms of a market today. But that's juxtaposed against their share of production. And this chart reflects the share, worldwide market share, based on headquarters origin of the companies. So the U.S. here means U.S. companies have a 51% market share. And this has been, as you can see, it's fluctuated quite a bit. And the history of this chart is actually quite interesting. And I'll just take a slight detour and just explain it a little bit. If you look at where the lines crossed, Japan and the U.S. crossed in the early 80s, that was as a result of a series of essentially unfair trading practices on the part of Japan, but also reflected the need for the U.S. industry to come together. And through some historic trade agreements, including the Japan Semiconductor Agreement and the creation of Semitech, that chart was able to turn around. And it's a very interesting story. I'd be happy to talk more about it during the Q&A. But the point here is that you see China doesn't even show up on this chart. And that's because most estimates are in terms of their Chinese headquartered companies have less than a 3% global market share. So that's quite a juxtaposition of China's consumption versus its production. And as Dieter said, the gap is growing. And it's growing rapidly. As I said, when the U.S. industry confronted some challenges, we approached those in a collaborative way, in which we came together through a series of partnerships. And this chart just sort of shows the evolution of technology. And essentially, I'd be happy to go into more detail on this, but in each major challenge that the U.S. industry faced, and now the global industry faced, the industry came together, formed various consortia that enabled it to move beyond it. And it's that collaboration and partnership that we believe has really underpinned the success of the U.S. industry. One example is our nanoelectronics research initiative. And this is an initiative of SIA and the Semiconductor Research Corporation searching for the next switch.
And I just, by the way, add, Brian, I think you guys win the award for the best acronyms.
I'll take it. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So, everyone has their thing. Mind and swan. And, we put some effort in. I won't go into each of the various consortia in any detail, but that is to say that you know, each of these is aimed at a different challenge. And this consortia, for example, is aimed at what is the next switch? What is the post-CMOS evolution? What is the next, you know, evolution of the transistor? Some really interesting technology out there that's being looked at. New types of switches, new types of interconnect technologies that are that offer dramatic growth. And so, you know, I think there's some who say the end of scaling, CMOS scaling is coming, and that's going to be a major crisis for the industry. We're looking beyond that into what are the new next technologies, and from what we've seen so far, the future is very, very bright. But it's not only in this area, there are a number of other industry challenges that the industry is coming together today to solve. And I'll just mention two here. Again, happy to go into more detail in these. One is the 450 consortium. This is the transition of the industry from 300 millimeter to 450 millimeter wafer size. It's a huge technical challenge, and it's something that can't be solved by any one company. It has to be the industry coming together, and it's not just the U.S. industry. It's industries from around the world that are coming together to face this challenge. And we believe that the only way to overcome these types of challenges, such as the transition in wafer sizes, such as the next switch technology, is to come together and collaborate. That's been our history. It's been a unique aspect of the U.S. semiconductor industry, and it's something that that we continue to do. Another one here is the 3D Enablement Center. This is looking at three-dimensional chip technology, which is both a big challenge and a big opportunity. One of the guiding principles for our industry has been what we call the ITRS, and this is the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors. And this was actually established in 1992 by Gordon Moore, who had sort of a breakthrough concept of what if we could come together and put together a roadmap of where technology has been and where it's going across a number of different fields. And it has really evolved into an enormous network of researchers from around the world that come to look at not only where is the scaling technology going and what is the cadence for that, but also what are the, we call more than more, the interaction of these technologies with people through sensors, passives, through even biochips and new types of biotechnology. And so this has evolved into now an international venture that includes researchers from the U.S., Europe, Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. We look at this is the guiding principle for many researchers in our industry, and it's exactly the type of thing that we would welcome China to be part of, because we believe that coming together we'll be able to solve these problems, and it's not it's only coming together we can solve these problems. And so it's looking at all the different bottlenecks, and we'd like certainly for to have China be part of this. And you know, this is sort of the one of the key elements of the collaboration that has enabled our industry, and that's what we'd like to see. And I think that is the solution for China's issue in terms of growing their own industry. They are already involved in a lot of the supply chain, global supply chains, but to actually be involved in looking forward into what the next technologies are, we believe is what is crucial for China's evolution. I'll switch and look at the some of the Chinese views of government views of how their industry is evolving. Dieter mentioned strategic industries and the 12-5-year plan. This is really just a chart which he explained it quite well. Which they see the IC industry as the core component for all of the other key industries they're trying to evolve. That's how they look at the semiconductor industry. And that's I actually wish a lot of people in Washington could look at the semiconductor industry that way. But it is a very forward looking view, and it's something that that shows how determined they are to build a semiconductor industry. The 5-year plan specifically identifies three priority areas: chip design, manufacturing and packaging and testing, And the overall goal is to double the size of the IC market, achieve an annual average of 18% growth, account for 15% of the global IC market, and meet 30% of domestic demand for chips. In other words, achieve a state where 30% of IC products used in domestic applications are developed independently by Chinese enterprises. That's the goal here. And clearly, while this goal is very well defined, our view is that the focus in achieving it needs to be a collaborative approach and looking through international consortia, participating more closely with the global industry. There was the recent news article about how China is building the tallest skyscraper in the world in 90 days. There's probably no doubt they'll achieve that. I'm not so sure I'd want my office in that, but they will they will achieve that. And our view is you can't look at building a semiconductor industry like you look at building a building, that it requires a lot more of an ecosystem approach, a collaborative approach, and we certainly very much welcome China's participation in the ecosystem. There are key policies that are going to enable the Chinese semiconductor industry to develop, and clearly there are two main ones actually that I'll discuss for a couple of minutes. The first is intellectual property protection broadly, and the second is free and open markets. And we believe that these are the enabling conditions, and we have. Fortunately, in the semiconductor industry, a mechanism that enables us to deal with a lot of these policy challenges, and it's called the World Semiconductor Council, and it really came out of the Japan negotiations and has now grown into a global organization that China has joined, and China's an active participant in, and we look forward to their more active participation going forward. But in terms of intellectual property, that's the key. For an industry that invests 18% of revenues in research and development, intellectual property is the absolute key. And so a core starting principle for China to develop that, their own domestic industry, is to respect intellectual property. The flip side of intellectual property is anti-counterfeiting. And right now, the major global source of counterfeit semiconductors, which is a serious threat, a real clear and present danger, here in the United States and around the world, is China. Essentially, what they do is they remark e-waste and old chips and ship them. And certainly the Chinese government has shown that when they focus on this issue, when they have the serious will to stop counterfeiting happening in China, they can do it. And we would certainly call on them to focus more directly. And I think that should be an important part of our trade policy as well. Free and open markets are critical. The growth of the semiconductor industry has been a global industry, has been enabled by the Information Technology Agreement established in 1996, and it has been important. The ITA has grown from $1.2 trillion to $4 trillion in terms of duty-free products, a 233% increase, and semiconductors make up a substantial portion of that. A recent WTO study on the ITA noted that semiconductors are the largest IT product category covered in the ITA and accounted for 33% of global exports of IT products in 2010. And so if China wants to expand its domestic industry, it needs to embrace an expanded Information Technology Agreement. And the reason that the Information Technology Agreement needs to expand is that technology is changing, and there are new types of semiconductors that are not covered under the existing ITA. And a couple of them are technology we call multi-component or multi-chip packages. And this is essentially the old circuit board is now on a chip, and that chip isn't necessarily covered by the ITA. And so we're looking for the ITA to expand duty-free treatment. And the World Semiconductor Council We have established agreement among all of the industries, including China, to do just that. And we look for an ITA to keep pace with technology and expand. Sure, I will. Another key policy area is in the area of encryption. Nearly all ICT products contain encryption technology. The industry increasingly relies on global voluntary technology standards, but because encryption is so common, unnecessary regulation can really inhibit the ability to trade in these goods. And so we are calling on the Chinese industry and have agreed in the WSC to avoid policies that regulate commercial products with encryption. This is a very important aspect and something that we need to build on. I'll stop there. I would simply say that from our perspective as an industry, China's development of their semiconductor industry is a good thing. We applaud that, and as long as it's done in a way that is free and fair, that has open markets, protection for intellectual property, and international standards, we're very much looking forward to the growth of the industry. And one of the nice things about our industry is that innovation is not a zero-sum game. The pie is not a fixed thing. We've proven throughout the years that where innovation can come from all around the world, we can grow that pie. So we're not competing over the slices here. But in order to enable this global ecosystem to develop, there has to be the right types of policies in place. And so we look forward to continue to work with China on this.
Great. Thank you, Brian. Thank you to all our speakers. So we'll open it up for questions in just a second, and we'll also adjourn precisely at 10:30, just so you know. A couple of things. One, Brian, you mentioned Semitech and also SRC was up there just as a raw, naked advertisement. We released a report Tuesday on how a national network of manufacturing innovation should be structured, and we had a representative from SRC on that panel up on the Hill. And SRC is a great model of that, as is Semitech, and the administration now wants to replicate that and create these kinds of industry partnerships with some government funding and with lead industry funding leadership, which is really the model for Semitech. There is government funding there. There was at SRC. There still is in parts of it. And certainly the Nano initiative, but there is with industry leadership. Second point, Brian mentioned the ITA. There's, again, on our website, we did a fairly significant report on IT expansion and why that's so important. So let me just ask a question to all three of you. You know, there's really kind of, if you think about this kind of conceptually, we have this competitive advantage. You think about it as a box sort of moving forward, and on the one hand, we're losing stuff off the back end, so other countries catch up and they're able to take market share away at the back end. And our at the same time, we're adding things on the front end, if you will. So when you go down to the larger wafer size, think about that as going on, adding onto the front end. Or when you go down to a smaller nanometer, you think about that as adding something onto the front end. So I think really our challenge as a country is to accelerate the expansion of the front end, but at the same time, to slow down the sort of creative destruction, if you will, of the back end, when that is being done through inappropriate means. And we've heard about some of those standards manipulation, intellectual property theft, and some other things. But my question is, are the Chinese at risk? I'm chairing this U.S.-China Innovation Experts Group with the White House, and in one of our meetings in Beijing last year, we met with a government official at a ministry, and he was very upfront about some of the Chinese challenges as he saw them, and he said, we have this, he didn't say it in this many words, we have this proclivity to pick technology just as they're about to sunset. And so he talks about the fact that they put all of this money into VCRs, and they built VCR factories right about the time DVD players came out. And he called this, as a very interesting term he called this a tragedy. This was the Chinese tragedy. They picked these things. And I wonder, in this case, you know, it's a little ways away before we get to quantum computing. We don't know what the next CMOS is going to be, quantum bio, whatever. But are the Chinese doing the same thing? Conversely, is this our big opportunity to just stay way out in front of them? And so, Dieter, do you want to start with that, or do we go to see Kirby's thoughts?
I also would actually appreciate the opportunity to respond to what we heard.
Sure.
But first,
yep.
So we have the debate on the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership.
You need a mic.
So in this country, we have the debate on the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership Program, which exactly, you know, tries to get a grips with the question that you pose, Rob. How can we actually, in which area can we actually develop new sources of competitive advantage and technological advantage? And one of the areas is obviously in integrating manufacturing services and innovation. That's our strength. And we can use potentially disruptive new technologies like, for instance, additive manufacturing and a whole list of other things to do just that. So that's something which in the medium term can actually help us, you know, to retain our strength, our competitive strength. With regard to offshoring or, you know, the movement of the foundation of any industry, including the IT industry, semiconductors. I think that thing has happened. That, you know, is something that we cannot anymore with the very, with the instruments of the current trade diplomacy, we cannot actually reverse that or even slow that down. I have a very pessimistic view on that.
So, in other words, the policies you're suggesting we shouldn't even engage in?
There are two.
That would be the purpose of those policies, would be to slow down inappropriate loss on the back end, if you will.
If we would actually have the will to create a strategic trade diplomacy, which would mean, you know, we need more resources. We need more people who actually deeply understand, you know, what's driving innovation strategies in countries like China, India, Brazil, and Russia for that matter. If we have that, then I'm all for a smart, well-funded, proactive trade diplomacy also on these issues. I was trying, you know, to emphasize we need focus. And the key focus, I think on that we agree, is we need to find ways to better share intellectual property, in particular, essential patents for really important standards. That's an issue, you know, which is absolutely critical. And so far, we haven't found a way from our side, nor have the Chinese found a way from their side, really to get to grips with that.
Let's now hear from Kirby. Your thoughts on that question? Can we stay out in front fast enough? It's really the question.
Well, I think that as long as the technology cadence stays on the two-year cadence that it's been historically, I think the answer is yes. You know, the question is when does that stop? You know, when do we run out of physics, basically? And, you know, people have always said that we were getting close to that, and we've always been able to break through that. But at some point in time, it does reach a limit. But even still, at the tails of the technologies, if you will, it's not clear to me that the Chinese industry itself is necessarily gaining traction. They're not climbing up the backs of other foundries, for example, that are at the 65 nanometer node or at the 45 nanometer node yet. So I still believe that the semiconductor manufacturing industry, the fab part of that business in China, is still quite immature.
Okay, thank you. Brian, did you want to add to that?
Sure, I think just, two comments. One is that we do need those, you know, strong intellectual property protection, strong trade diplomacy to ensure that the back end, as you said, isn't inappropriately, and I couldn't agree more on intellectual property and some of the aspects that we talked about, but international standards, I think, is the key. So China needs to be looking toward these international standards, and our government needs to insist that China follow international standards. So there is this competition. Can we stay out in front? history has shown where there's a fair field and no favor, the U.S. semiconductor industry and our ecosystem that I described out-innovates anyone. But there are but China's not only looking backward; they're also looking forward very wisely. They're investing in nanoelectronics at a significant amount of money. And now we have the great advantage of this country of our research universities, which are unparalleled, and that is our strategic advantage. And we focus the SRC programs through those great research universities, and that does give us an advantage. But it is important to note that China's not only looking backwards; they're also investing heavily in the new types of technologies, and that's something our government needs to be sure we keep in mind.
Just one point, I mean, we do have great universities, but as we pointed out last year in a report, we're now fallen to 22nd in the world, or among 30 OECD nations, in the amount of government and industry support to our universities as share of GDP. So we've got the capabilities, but if we don't keep investing in them, then that's the huge risk. So comments or questions from folks here? You can identify yourself also, please.
Shahid Yusuf from the Growth Dialogue at George Washington University. I have a question for Deepak particularly, which is that, you know, you talked about Chinese indigenous innovation strategy. What exactly are they doing in that regard? I mean, they talk about it, but one would like to know a little bit more about the ingredients of the strategy. Mm-hmm. Relatedly, you mentioned about moving up the sort of learning curve, and China in relation to some of the other East Asian countries. My question here is, are they moving up more slowly than some of the other countries did in the past? Mm-hmm. And the final and related point also is, if they are moving more slowly than you think they ought to be going, given the amount of investment they're doing, mm-hmm. what is it that they are not doing right as far as innovation activity is concerned, as distinct from intellectual property protection and so on, or is that really the binding constraint on them?
Mm-hmm. Right away. Learning curve more slowly. The challenge is much, much more complex than it was for Taiwan or before for Japan. So the challenge is actually, mind-boggling. They have to do it on many different levels simultaneously. Number one, that's the external constraint. The internal constraint is, of course, it's a huge country, officially centralized, but as I emphasized, it actually is a highly fragmented policy-making system. Interagency rivalries cut across, so that constrains the speed of, you know, moving along this learning curve. In some areas, the speed is mind-boggling. In IC design, I show this in terms of quantitative indicators, the speed is mind-boggling. In terms of learning of some of the teams, you know, you meet when you go into these companies, Chinese companies, the speed is mind-boggling. But in other areas, in particular, of course, in wafer fab, as we heard from Kirby, it's very slow. And this has to do with industry structure. I mean, SOEs play an important role. You know, the regional, the competition between regional governments is very important. It's a long list. Like, there are multiple causes for that. Some areas they are slower, in others they are much, much faster. And they have the capacity actually to focus. LED is one you mentioned. So that's a strength. What is it that they are doing wrongly? Maybe I already mentioned it. It's systemic in a way. So, for instance, in my little field, you know, we did the study on the Chinese standardization system. The people on the ground who were actually tasked to come up with new regulations, government policies, they would say, we need decision autonomy at the level of the technical committees. We don't need someone up there, you know, who tells us what to do or not what to do. So maybe by way of an example, the ingredients would take too long time. We need to talk bilaterally.
Yes, sir.
Gil Kaplan from King & Spalding, and thank you all for this very interesting presentation. I wonder if we should be a little bit more, I guess, worried about what happens if all this good advice that we're saying China should perhaps follow and develop a better industry actually does occur. We have a $300 billion trade deficit with China, as you know, and all of it manufactured goods. If they really build up this semiconductor industry, I think it's going to be quite problematic. It looks like we have a slight trade surplus on semiconductors with China, but very, very few products, including very few high-tech products, do we have any kind of trade surplus in. And if you look at what happened on Japan, they started at nothing. We had a very robust industry, but by adopting a very vigorous trade and subsidy policy, they overtook us until we were very forthright and basically fighting back. To try to avoid that situation with China, don't we have to be a little bit more worried about what happens if they do build up this industry? What's going to happen to our ability to compete if that occurs?
Kirby, feel free to jump in at any time on these, by the way. I know it's harder sometimes when you're on Skype. So,
quick response. No. Go ahead, please.
No, actually, that's probably not my area of expertise. I'll refer to you all there. Thanks.
Sure, thank you.
So, the should be concerned. I don't think so. We should be dramatically concerned. We should be concerned about what we need to do in order to upgrade our industry, our capabilities. And thanks to the work, actually, of this organization, IDIF, we get enough, you know, fodder for thought what we need to do. I give you one example why I think we should not be that much concerned about the threat. Yesterday, I gave a talk at the Fed. And the Fed is, you know, really very much in the process of trying to redefine what's manufacturing and what's services. In 2017, we will have an incomplete new set of, you know, definitions of these terms. So that would, for instance, mean that any IC design activities in companies like Qualcomm or Nvidia would actually become manufacturers. That would mean that U.S. exports to China in this particular field would actually increase quite substantially, you know. And that, you know, then we have a slightly different set of data. We have, here's one specialist from the NSF who looks at the advanced technology product trade data. And this aggregation is the key. And unfortunately, in the media, we only have, you know, the top figures, which often can be very, you know, misleading. So I would say, I mean, we heard from Kirby, that in particular in manufacturing, there's a huge gap. I can say, I think, with some degree of confidence, because I studied the IC design industry quite carefully, there's still a huge gap. The Chinese are doing an excellent job. I mean, maybe I should turn it around now. If I compare with what's happening in other countries, they have moved forward. But they, unsurprisingly, they are still facing very fundamental challenges, in particular in terms of quality.
Sure, but I guess, Dieter, where I would disagree with that, I'd maybe align myself more, I think, with what Brian said, which was, it seems to me we've got to do two things. One is we've got to have the right policies here, including funding, continuing to fund research and these kinds of partnerships, SRC and the Nano Center and the others, and then do it at a more robust basis, make sure we have the right engineering talent and science talent. But at the same time, there are things that you've pointed out quite well and articulate in your report, which to me are inappropriate, the standards manipulation. To me, you mentioned LTE. The Chinese LTE standard is an inferior standard, and everybody knows that. The fact that they've developed is because they don't want to pay intellectual property fees for a global standard that you know, that is the best standard, the current LTE standard. Intellectual property, I mean, the point that Brian raised, that if you've all seen the GAO report on faulty, fraudulent chips in our defense industrial base, I mean, this is, you know, to me, outrageous. I mean, the Chinese government would easily, if not stop this, certainly shrink it quite significantly. And they just choose not to because they see it as a legitimate export industry, slapping another name on an old chip that doesn't work. So I guess I wouldn't give them as much of a pass. Whether they're going to be successful or not, these are illegitimate practices that violate the spirit of the WTO.
Can we? Sorry.
Go ahead, Brian.
No, I was just going to respond to Gil. What we ought to be worried about is that China doesn't become Japan through unfair trade practices. And, you know, those types of things these days aren't as clear, probably, as they were earlier. You know, it's the type of, it's the standards, Zook algorithm standard for mobile phones, for example. It's, you know, these types of trade barriers are harder to see these days. And I think we ought to be very worried that they're not developing these types of unfair standards that inappropriately force technology into one area. And so I think that's where we ought to be worried. I think if we can have a fair field of no favor on this, we've proven time and again that not only can the U.S. industry, through university research and company research, out-innovate anyone, but that, you know, it's so critical for us to be able to maintain that here. So,
Dean, I'm going to go in order I saw him. So
I'll pass.
Okay, yes.
Derek Hill, National Science Foundation. Question on intellectual property protections. China is often singled out for having weaker standards, and clearly it seems like its infrastructure, it doesn't have the institutional capability, even if it is saying it wants to strengthen its standards. But you hear a lot of observers talking about even the more Western-based companies in technology. If we look at the smartphone industry, you have the big companies like Apple and Google. They're essentially buying up patent portfolios, and the critics say basically it's for them to augment their position and maybe get a monopoly position. And you know, they're doing patents so they can strengthen their position and prevent other companies from innovating. And I wonder if you see this maybe in semiconductors as a problem where it's not a question of how strong intellectual property protection, but maybe the level you can patent, you know, components where companies will use that to block further innovation.
I would like to add something to what we discussed before, which actually also relates to that. So my main concern is actually with regard to what's happening in China on information security standards and certification. That's a big issue, as we know. These are someone in the back knows exactly what we are talking about. So this is an issue where we really need to have a very, you know, not only hard, but effective negotiation position. I think that's important. But what your comment, Derek Hill's comment, is referring to, we have an imperfect market for intellectual property. And China, you know, plays with that market, and sometimes it pushes things to the limit, and that is an issue for our trade diplomacy. We need to deal with that. But China is not the only one who's doing that. So we have a systemic problem. That's why we are talking about patent pools. We are talking about the management of essential patents for standards, right? So these are systemic problems. It's not just China.
Patent quality is a global issue, and it's something we all have to focus. But in China, I think it's becoming more than that. These junk patents that they have in China, where they're not examined, you simply file an application, you're granted a patent. That is a huge, huge trade barrier that ought to be a focus. And so while clearly patent quality needs to be improved globally, in China, this is a particular issue that does need focus. And so you raise a very good point.
Well, particularly with the way the court system over there will then interpret those. And to your point about it's difficult to build a system, it is difficult to build a system, but there are clear things they could do that they're not doing. One of them on IP is the government could simply start to outlaw agencies stealing software. I mean, everybody says, well, it's hard to stop somebody on the street when you go to one of the cities and you see them, you know, selling pirated Windows or whatever. Government agencies do this. They admit this. They don't license all the software that they buy. This could be done tomorrow. All this requires is a
dictate from the central government to say, if you are get caught doing this, you will be in big, big trouble, and they would be able to legally buy all their software. They just choose not to do that because it costs money. And maybe I have an idea. That's how we could solve our trade deficit. I mean, our budget deficit. We'll just stop buying software for the federal government and save a lot of money. Yes, sir.
Mark Thompson, the Economic Security Center. My question is primarily for Kirby. For many years, a prevailing thought with SMIC on the fabrication side in China was that their capability was limited by their access to leading-edge production equipment and process technology. As it stands now, they pretty much can get access to all of that. They can get 193 nanometer immersion tools. They can get process technology from IBM. So, but yet they still remain about 2 to 2.5 process nodes behind the leaders in foundry like TSMC. Why is that?
Well, I think that as the technology nodes have gotten more and more complex, the integrated nature of the nodes have just made it much more difficult to manufacture. And unless you grow up in the industry and you really have seen what has happened, I don't think that you get a good sense with regards to just how interconnected really the recipes are. And for China to come in and a lot of their academia, if you will, that are coming basically to this side of the of the party at a late stage, I think they miss the integrative nature with regards to these technologies and just how complex they are. Now, I think over time they will catch up with regards to that. So I do believe that the SMICs are going to get very good at these technologies, but they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
Connie Chen, just to follow up on that question, have you guys in your research seen, in terms of the indigenous innovation strategy that China is employing, are they hiring people from the U.S. to lead efforts in China to develop labs or work on production processes and so forth, hiring that talent rather than growing that talent?
That's an excellent question.
I can speak specifically here. From Intel's perspective, yes, we have seen some of our employees, even some of our employees out of our research and development areas that were hired and lured away to China, to both Taiwanese companies as well as local Chinese companies. So there is some of that, and that is a big concern for us.
It's a powerful pull effect when you visit companies like Spreadtrum or RDA, you see immediately, even when you walk around, you see people from Taiwan, for sure. You see people from Russia, from Japan. Moonlighting right now in these companies is very, very, obvious. So the movement of, or the mobility of knowledge through these kind of, people imports is speeding up learning processes. The team leaders in the projects, without naming the company in this particular case, IC Design, these are all people, they are returnees from the US, Chinese coming back from the US, using, leading edge management technology, project management technologies. So that actually helps to smoothen or accelerate the process of catching up. That's what I meant before. There are two models. There's the indigenous innovation policy, still very much top-down, and there is something which comes from the bottom in these companies, and there is a tension, and we should be able to play with that. We need to understand that, and we should be able, to use that. That's basically
great.
My argument. And can I, one last remark?
I mean, really quick.
Yes. It's very encouraging what you say, cooperation. And this reflects the deep integration of this industry, so it makes sense. But in order to do that, we need to sort out the issues related not only to IPR, but also to standards. And that, we still have a huge gap in our capacity to deal with that, correct?
Correct.
Great.
Great. Well, thank you. First of all, I want to commend everyone to take a look at Dieter's work at the East-West Center on the website. I think a number of the reports that he's been basing his analysis on are there and available. I also want to thank Kirby. I know it's really late there, and you've been a good sport. Go home to your wife and have a Chinese beer before you go to bed tonight. So thank you so much, and thank you to Brian, and thank you all to you. Appreciate you coming here.